The Guardian. Guardian Daily. News from The Guardian.
Hello, it's John Dennis here with Guardian Daily. It's Thursday, April the 10th. Today, with the election results still under wraps in Zimbabwe, Robert Mugabe unleashes his shock troops.
They made people stand up and sing ZANU-PF songs, the ruling party, and liberation war songs. Those that didn't sing hard enough or didn't chant the slogans loud enough were beaten and slapped.
Also today, charged with abandoning her daughter, Karen Matthews appears in court. And as G7 finance ministers meet in Washington to discuss the credit crunch, we seek advice from economist Joseph Stiglitz.
What is needed is fiscal policy and a restructuring of the financial system to deal with the immediate crisis of home foreclosures, which is not only an economic problem, but actually a social problem.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis. From Guardian.co.uk.
But first, it's over to Sandy Waugh, who's got today's news headlines and the papers.
The Bank of England is expected to cut interest rates in an announcement today. Experts predict a reduction of 0.25%. The current rate is 5.25%. However, rates offered to borrowers by commercial banks are likely to remain largely unchanged. The move is expected to come amid reports of the biggest dip in the UK housing market since 1992. Follow the latest news on this throughout the day at guardian.co.uk/money. Gordon Brown's announced he will not be attending the opening ceremony of the Beijing Olympics in August. He will, however, attend the closing ceremony, where London will inherit the Games for 2012. The Olympic torch journey descended further into farce last night as authorities in San Francisco axed most of the planned route and parts of the ceremony were conducted away from crowds in secret. Birmingham City's managing director Karen Brady and the football club's co-owner David Sullivan have been arrested on suspicion of corruption. The club confirmed last night the pair were interviewed by appointment and were happy to cooperate with police. Seven others have been arrested and bailed during the investigation, including Portsmouth manager Harry Redknapp and Tottenham Hotspur fullback Pascal Shimbonda. Nepalese are voting in an historic election intended to bring communist insurgents into the country's democratic mainstream. The election is expected to bring an end to a monarchy that's ruled for centuries. More on this to come in Guardian Daily. Morris dancers and Daleks will feature in this year's proms programme in an attempt to widen access to the traditional concerts at the Royal Albert Hall. BBC Radio 3 controller Roger Wright also announced the prom's first ever free concert in his first season as director of the festival. In football, the stage is still set for an all-English Champions League final. Manchester United beat Roma at Old Trafford last night to set up a semi-final with Barcelona. Chelsea and Liverpool make up the other semi-final. Turning now to today's papers, and The Sun and The Mirror both lead with reports on the mother of Shannon Matthews, who's been remanded in custody on a charge of child neglect. Both papers say she's been denied bail for her own safety. The Mail urges the government to consider a ban of food additives on its front page, a move, it says, which could prevent hyperactivity in children. The Express and The Independent both lead on the news of the pound's fall against the euro. The Express says it'll mean a big hike in the cost of continental holidays, while The Independent says the cost of imports from Europe will also rise. The Daily Telegraph's interpretation of figures released by the IMF yesterday is that Britain will be hit hardest by the credit crunch. The Times, meanwhile, claims the battle for public support for human and animal hybrid embryos has been won. More news and analysis at guardian.co.uk.
Robert Mugabe's thugs are using violence and intimidation against opposition supporters. The Guardian's Africa correspondent, Chris McGreal, is in Zimbabwe. He reports today on a campaign of terror against rural voters.
Well, to give you an idea, I was in Makoto, which is northeast of Harare, in Mashonaland East, and I went to a hospital there where 8 armed men had descended on the hospital, had taken the patients and the nurses out of the building, stopped cars that were passing by in the road, and forced everybody to a meeting, which they said that they knew that the area from the ballot box returns had voted for the opposition, and this was one last chance. If this happened again, they would be back to kill people. They made people stand up and sing ZANU-PF songs, the ruling party, and liberation war songs. Those that didn't sing hard enough or didn't chant the slogans loud enough were beaten and slapped. And then they were asked to identify any opposition supporters, which on that occasion didn't happen. Then the armed men piled into the back of a pickup truck and moved on to the next village. And they've been going through Mashona land from village to village over the past 3 days, doing this, gathering people, forcing shops closed, and essentially threatening them, saying, "You've made a big mistake by voting for the opposition. Don't repeat that mistake."
And have there been similar scenes throughout Zimbabwe?
Well, certainly in certain parts of Zimbabwe, which you can pretty much identify as the areas where the vote switched over from or significantly moved from the ruling ZANU-PF to the opposition. Mashonaland's one area in the Makoto area. For instance, although the opposition candidate for parliament lost, in fact, he picked up 42% of the vote. This is an area that was very strongly pro-Mugabe a few years ago. There have been similar assaults and intimidation in Manika land, out in the areas in the east bordering Mozambique, and down in Matabele land in the south, where we've had a report today of 60 families being forced off their land because ZANU-PF was able to identify from the local ballot box returns that area has largely voted for the opposition, and they've all been driven out their homes.
What's the best hope now for the opposition?
Well, I think they have a real problem. At a national level, they continue to say, you know, that they can retain their support and resist this, although they've also warned that they might pull out of a second round if it gets very much more bloody. But if you talk to the opposition on the ground, and for instance, the parliamentary candidates for the MDC in the areas I was in, they confess now that support for the opposition presidential candidate, Morgan Tsvangirai, will probably fall off. They think the intimidation is working, that people are definitely scared, and that they can see from this that the MDC is not able to protect them. The best hope, of course, is that there's some kind of outside monitoring on the ground. The MDC wants the United Nations, they want Europeans, Americans, not regional monitors whom they don't trust. But a lot of the problem is that without the results released, there's no second round campaign launched. And of course, that allows the ruling party to go around and do this without anybody except local human rights monitors and reporters watching them. And that's the danger, that all the damage is being done now before the second round election campaign is actually launched.
Chris McGreal, and there's full coverage of events in Zimbabwe at guardian.co.uk/Zimbabwe. Also on The Guardian's website today, Nicholson Baker is an American writer of fiction and non-fiction, according to Wikipedia. And Nicholson Baker loves Wikipedia. Read why at guardian.co.uk/technology. On its 50th anniversary, Jonathan Glancy celebrates the design of the Campaign for Nuclear Disarmament logo at blogs.guardian.co.uk/arts. The US Masters begins tonight with Tiger Woods looking to win his fourth major tournament in a row. Will Buckley blogs from Augusta, Georgia at blogs.guardian.co.uk/sport. Finance ministers from the G7, richest countries in the world, are meeting in Washington to discuss possible coordinated action to alleviate the effects of the global credit squeeze. There's been bad news for Britain this week, with the biggest monthly fall in house prices since the early 90s and a downbeat growth forecast from the International Monetary Fund. Well, Joseph Stiglitz is a former advisor to President Bill Clinton and ex-chief economist at the World Bank, Nobel Prize winner too. I asked him what he thinks the policymakers should do.
One of the points that is likely to be raised is the importance of cooperative action, coordinated action. What is going on right now, to some extent, is the United States is exporting its problems to the rest of the world. Its exchange rate is falling, and the increase in exports is good for the United States, but obviously a problem for Western Europe and Japan, other countries around the world. The big issue is that Bush administration still seems wary about doing anything. The Democrats in Congress have been calling for more action,
And he has said we need to wait and see to make sure that more medicine is needed. The stimulus is enough. And I think that's a misguided approach.
Malcolm Knight, the general manager at the Central Bankers Central Bank, the Bank of International Settlements, has said that the world's central banks shouldn't take blanket action to intervene in the markets because they'll only store up further problems in a few years' time. What would you say to that?
I think he is raising an important point that in the current situation, monetary policy is not likely to be effective in reversing the downturn. What the Fed has been doing has been basically preventing a meltdown. It is having very little effect in restarting the American economy. The basic point is fairly simple, that what has fed the American economy for the last 5 years has been excessive consumption. Savings rates plummeted to zero. It was excessive consumption by people taking money out of their mortgages, mortgage equity withdrawals. The excess liquidity and the lax regulation did keep the economy going, part offsetting the negative effects of the Iraq war and the high oil prices. But anybody looking at the situation then said, oh, you're just postponing the problem. And they would have been right. And what he is saying right now is that another injection of liquidity is not going to result in people taking more money out of their mortgages, buying more houses, but rather this excess liquidity will look around the world, look for safer places, look for a new place to have a bubble, perhaps in Asia, and therefore not contribute to global economic stability. So I think he's right. I think this is an instance where what is needed is fiscal policy and a restructuring of the financial system to deal with the immediate crisis of home foreclosures, which is not only an economic problem, but actually a social problem.
Joseph Stiglitz, if Barack Obama as president offered you a job as economic advisor, as has been rumoured that he might do, would you accept it?
Well, I had that kind of an experience back in the 90s under President Clinton. We had a very good economic period. Clearly, if the president asks you, you can't turn it down. The question is really, what is the best way of making a contribution, whether it's involved in the day-to-day hard work, and it really is hard work of being involved as a day-to-day advisor, or the broader, you might say, gray beard that I now have. I think that it might be more appropriate for me to be in the gray beard category.
Joseph Stiglitz, recording for Guardian Weekly Podcast, and you can subscribe to that and listen to a longer version of that interview at guardian.co.uk/audio. I'm John Dennis. Still to come on Guardian Daily, voters in Nepal have their say on a new constitution and the abolition of the monarchy. And in our weekly celebrity spot, Ulrika Johnson tells us why she doesn't regret posing for men's magazines.
I kind of didn't really understand, or maybe I was so comfortable with my body that it didn't really affect me profoundly, and think that, gosh, this is either cheapening me or giving somebody a thrill without them having to work for it.
But first, the mother of 9-year-old schoolgirl Shannon Matthews has been remanded in custody in connection with her daughter's disappearance. Yesterday, The Guardian's Martin Wainwright joined local people outside Dewsbury Magistrates Court in West Yorkshire, where Karen Matthews was charged with perverting the course of justice and child neglect.
A lot of money and a lot of work for these police, and a lot of upset for everybody what lived up there having their houses ransacked by the police. And everything else, upsetment. So
Martin, well, this has been an extraordinary turn of events, hasn't it?
It certainly has. Every turn of events in this saga of Shannon Matthews has been extraordinary. And this matches all the previous ones.
And Karen Matthews, not the first family member to be held in connection with Shannon's disappearance.
No, she's the third. Probably the most important is that the child's step-uncle, a chap called Michael Donovan, is in jail, remanded in jail, accused of abducting her and falsely imprisoning her. He's the chap in whose flat, about a mile away from Shannon's house, she was found hidden in the storage cupboard of a bed 24 days after she disappeared. So he's in custody in prison. And then Shannon's stepfather, Craig Meehan, 22-year-old, he's who lived in the same house as Shannon and her mum on Dewsbury Moor. He's remanded in custody, accused of possessing indecent images of children on a computer.
Meanwhile, Shannon herself remains in the care of social services.
Yes, she does, and will do, I think, for a great length of time. And she's still being gently questioned by police to try to puzzle out what she knew about what went on.
And you do get a sense, listening to some of the people that you spoke to outside Dewsbury Magistrates Court, you do get a sense of how difficult it's been for them, because they were very much part of the hunt for Shannon for 24 days back in February and March.
Well, yeah, very much so. I mean, whatever transpires from all this, that was the case. I mean, I went both when they were searching and most kind of emotionally when Shannon was found. They had a really, you know, heartwarming, I'm sorry, it's a bit of a cliche word, but it was heartwarming celebration that everyone was so thrilled on Dewsbury Moor that the little girl had been found and all the worst fears had not been realised. And the other feeling outside the court was very much, you know, without coming to any sense of judgment about this, but it's been a very, very expensive police operation. It's topped £1 million now, and that's not including the salaries, the everyday salaries of people who were working normally. That's all the sort of extra work that's gone in. So there's this kind of really almost a sense of disbelief about what the way things are going. And it was kind of muted. That was the other thing that struck me. You know, as journalists, we tend to sort of expect certain things to happen. And I think a lot of people thought there'd be a sort of baying mob outside the court. And there wasn't that at all. People were quiet and rather subdued. And I think just astonished by what was going on their own, normally very run-of-the-mill doorstep.
Martin Wainwright. Nepal's first nationwide elections in almost 10 years take place today. The country's 17 million voters have been wooed by more than 70 political parties. The poll will almost certainly end the world's last Hindu monarchy. The Guardian's South Asia correspondent, Randeep Ramesh, says the elections are hugely significant.
They're the first elections in about a decade, and Nepal's having them in order to rewrite its constitution. Because they want to get rid of the king, who assumed absolute rule in 2005, which only lasted a year, because he was brought down by street protests in the Himalayan country. So it looks as if the monarchy will be ended by this new parliament that's being elected tomorrow, which will have 600-odd legislators in it.
And 13,000 people died over the last 10 years in what the Maoists call Nepal's People's War. Has the People's Liberation Army now made a successful transition from the bullet to the ballot box?
Well, it's been a partially successful transition. What they've done is they've kept their 30,000 soldiers in UN-sponsored camps, effectively disarming and demobilising. But they've created a sort of thuggish band of street militia known as the Young Communist League that go around sort of beating up people and extorting money. So they've made a sort of partial transition. Their leadership sort of tells me that it's minor problems, feudal mindsets, village mentalities that will ebb and fade with time. But a lot of people in Nepal are worried that the Maoists will put away the bullets, but they'll still carry a large club. I interviewed Maoist leader Prachanda at his Nepalese headquarters in Kathmandu and asked the chairman of the Maoist party how come an upper caste Brahmin could lead a party of the proletariat. He replied that all great Marxist leaders have come from the upper castes.
Crux of the matter is that what policy is following by what party? When we see in the international world, in international level, there also we see that although Karl Marx and Lenin and Mao Zedong, they themselves were from upper caste, upper level of their society.
And 10 years of communist insurgency hasn't done wonders for Nepal's economy.
No. The economy is in the doldrums. I mean, growing at sort of minuscule rates, especially compared to all its neighbours. And it's round about Rwanda. I'm sorry, it's Rwanda. It's about the same level as Rwanda in terms of per capita GDP. Now, the Maoists sort of say that they'll embrace the spirit of capitalism. They've seen the light and want to boost that tenfold within 10 years. But these are tall claims, easily made in election campaigns, but very difficult to pull off when you're in power.
And you mentioned the street militias allied to the Maoists. And there are also troops allied to King Gyendra that are still holed up in his palace.
There are. He's got a few thousand troops with him. He refused to leave. They were asked by politicians about 4 months ago, could they please vacate the royal palace because the monarchy was being dismantled? And they replied no, which it doesn't bode well for democratically elected representatives of the people who want to remove all signs of the monarchy from Nepal. I mean, there are two sides to this. The Nepalese people have traditionally always supported their king because he's seen as the great unifier of Nepal, in fact, the creator of modern-day Nepal. But because of this present monarch's ill-advised seizure of power in 2005, a lot of that goodwill has disappeared. And most people think that the army will eventually return to the barracks and let the king become just a normal citizen of Nepal.
Randeep Ramesh.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
Now, each week for The Guardian's features supplement G2, Hannah Poole interviews a famous person, and this week it's the television presenter Ulrika Johnson. She says she doesn't regret posing for men's magazines, and she explains how she's coped with criticism in the press.
I can understand people commenting on it, because it's not conventional. However, not conventional doesn't mean that something isn't good or isn't positive. And I've been absolutely staggered that the majority of the criticism has come from other women. Now, either that's based on, I don't know, envy or insecurity, I don't know what. But I've never questioned my own motives or my own means of getting to where I am today. The most important thing, and genuinely the only important thing, is the happiness and security of my children. And my children are in an environment where, you know, there are two ex-partners and a present partner. There's no feeling of there being, you know, a kind of, you know, hullabaloo of fathers coming and going. Why am I criticised for bringing up a child, albeit a sick child, in a really loving environment who's level-headed, bright and secure? I don't see what the problem is. On the other hand, I see we live in this, you know, you take a step back and I see that how we applaud this vacuous celebrity society. And I'd be better off if I was doing cocaine and heroin, actually, because I'd probably get a few TV commercials and a few presenting jobs. Without being ridiculous, that's genuinely how it seems to be that we kind of reward people. It's very, very back to our... And I wonder a lot about what signals that sends out to people, more than mummy's been in a relationship which failed, but now she's happy again. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, you know, my children understand, sometimes love doesn't work.
In that case, do you ever regret the sort of the Lad Mags persona?
I look back at the pictures of me in Lad Mags, and I actually think they're reasonably, with the exception of one shoot, respectful. I mean, there's no kind of... My agent refused to have me in just a bra or just, you know, tried to keep things reasonable, at least. I kind of didn't really understand, or maybe I was so comfortable with my body that it didn't really affect me profoundly and think that, gosh, this is either cheapening me or giving somebody a thrill without them having to work for it.
Ulrika Johnson talking to Hannah Poole. The producers today were Fiona Plant and Phil Maynard. My name's John Dennis. Thank you for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.